Welcome to the Casey Catch-Up. This week, we've got John Mann on, and I felt like we'd done a podcast already, but I had a look back and I don't think we have. So it's we've spoken a lot before, I guess, on socials, and basically we were chatting about the Barcelona race, and I wanted to get you on for that, but also, you know, I want to get to know more about you and share, I guess, your downwind journey. So, John, thanks for joining.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, mate.
Yeah, it's been cool.
It feels like we've been chatting for ages.
Yeah,
like through the Casey Club and for, I don't know, just and now with prep for Maui. So
it does feel like we've been, like, I guess the Coach Casey Club is, I guess, how we met, and following your progress has been really cool. And like downwinding in the Netherlands is something we want to get into, you know, because that's not something that, I guess, it's not exactly on your hit list for most people. You know, it's like Maui. Now you got, the Mediterranean, I mean, Western Australia, and Netherlands is a bit of a left field one, but it's cool to see and just shows you can do it anywhere. So why don't you talk to us about, I guess, a bit of background about you, even before you got into foiling, and then how you got into foiling.
All right. Before foiling, I spent a lot of time wakeboarding and kiting. That was kind of my entry into water sports. A bit later in life, school was kind of like athletics, rugby, like kind of your classic school sports. I did 400 hurdles and played center and wing. So a lot of running around, and that was it. Very competitive, but more competitive with myself. So I really went more down the athletics route than the 400, than the rugby route. That was kind of that. And then I got a job that shipped me off to Australia for a bit. So I lived in Brisbane, and then I got into kiting just before that. So kited a lot. And then in 2019, I was in a bit of a wakeboard bender, blew my knee up, tore my MCL. Lucky I didn't tear my ACL. Got a couple concussions and was like, oh, this sucks. I don't want to be out every time I get injured. And I also didn't want to not be on the water during my recovery. So then I got into kite foiling. And that was sort of my gateway drug into foiling. And actually that's something that when foils were bad or not bad, less developed at the start, I remember reading a few times people going, you should start in the discipline that you're best at. Because I was looking at surf foiling first, because the waves in Holland are pretty gutless. I think a good day here is like 2 foot and 5 seconds. People will froth for that. Like, you wouldn't look twice if you were anywhere else. So I was like, I want to start surf foiling. And then online it said, okay, pick the discipline you know best. So I was like, okay, I can kite pretty well. Started kite foiling. And then from kite foiling, I was like, oh, let's go kite foil in waves. And then it was so much work. I'd keep looping the kite. Kite kept falling out. If I got a really nice wave, I'd just have a yard sail because I'd ride the wave and then wouldn't bother with the kite and then swim in. So I was like, oh, you know what? I should probably just start surf foiling now. And then Voyager came along and I was like, oh shit, I want to do that. And one of my friends was like, oh, you know, Holland's perfect for it. There was a big scene of guys doing 14-foot downwinders on the inner lakes that we have here, the Markermeer and the IJsselmeer. So we were like, okay, let's work towards that. I couldn't paddle and I didn't want to combine learning to paddle and learning to foil downwind. So my hat's off to anyone who's doing that now. I see a lot of people doing that. It's a tough journey. So I learned to wing. I learned to wing just to downwind. Like, it's the quickest way to get on foil and get 4 hours downwind. So did that for a couple of months and then joined the Casey Club. And yeah, that's where the paddle journey started. And I think that's now, well, two and a half years ago.
Yeah. It's
like 5'10" by 28 wing board. Cause no one, it was impossible to get a Sonova. What were the other options? Or a Kalama E3, like the shipping and the import taxes.
So that was in the depths of COVID, huh? Cause like, I guess my Coach Casey Club downwind foil course was like pretty much a COVID project. You know, it was like, well, I can't coach, so why don't I just write down what I know and sort of try to coach online. And that's, yeah. So, and a lot of people were had time to spend on hobbies, I guess, because they couldn't travel.
Yeah, like coincided with, it was just after COVID, and then I started working the FIFO month on, month off job, which I kind of actually chose because I wanted to learn downwinding. And I was like, I need concentrated, focused time, right? So I did, I think in the first month that I had like the 6 months where I was winging downwind a lot, and I spent a couple weeks practicing on flat water. And then like my first proper month off, I think that was when I cracked it, because I went 26 days in a row with a mixture of, I had a couple buddies that were available, and had flexible schedules. So that's the downside of always being free for a month, is often people aren't free, but I got lucky there. And also my girlfriend gave me a few shuttles as well to help me keep the streak. So
it takes the whole team.
pretty much, yeah. If it wasn't, I would say if it wasn't for the crew here, it wouldn't have happened as quickly. Like I just had, it was really lucky that it was one of my mates. He's got a wing school, and I think he's got the record for the 11 cities in the Netherlands. It's like a 200-kilometer long distance event. So that's Nick van der Linde. So he's got a school, and it was the off season because it's the autumn. It was statistically the windiest time of the year for the Netherlands. One of my other mates, Yalis, who got me into downwinding, he was the one that was convinced me that getting a paddle was the way to go. He had a pretty flexible job. And then my other mate, Siebren, he's a freelancer. So between the three of us, or four of us, we could always coordinate some sort of shuttle. So yeah, it was sweet. But if it wasn't for them, you know, the progression for me wouldn't have been what it was. I think it did go pretty quick just because of frequency.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I was coaching a guy this morning, and he was saying, how long do you think it's going to take me to learn this downwind thing? And I basically said, it'll probably take you about 30 days to learn to foil, you know, at a competent level, and then probably another 30 days to figure out the downwind thing with a paddle. And it's like, oh, okay. So like, it's like 2 months. I'm like, yeah. But 2 months of foiling, like having the full day to sort of like back-to-back days. And so if you can't have back-to-back, it almost stretches out. Yeah, you know, every second day, all of a sudden it's 160 and 60, it's 120 days. But it's not even that. It's not linear like that, because if you have the gap, then you lose you almost have to start again. And then basically, the FIFO worked perfect for you by the sounds of it.
Yeah. And Siebren, he's a bit of a IT genius. So he wrote a little script, which we would put our GPS tracks into after, and it would just tell us percentage time on foil. And we kind of plotted that just out of curiosity to see, well, how long does it take someone to learn to downwind? We noticed you sort of like every run, your percentage on foil increases until you get to 50%. And once you can foil 50% of your run, you're getting enough foil time in that you're learning a lot. So then your sort of time on foil increases exponentially after that session where you've hit 50%. So for me, because I was going every day almost, that was day 9. And for him, because it was less frequent, it was session 29. Mm-hmm. So that really shows like it's more, and also I could prone and he couldn't. And I'd spent a lot of time wing downwinding, and he was a better paddler, so he went earlier to the paddle. So I think like it's a combination of how frequently can you go, and what's your foil background before you get into downwinding. But I think like, the time question is impossible to answer. You know, I think in the first 3 months that I was downwinding because of the FIFO thing, I had more sessions than your average guy does in a year, you know. Three times 20, 26, 25 days in a row. Or maybe the average guy gets between 50 and 120 sessions a year. Like someone who's got a 9-to-5, kids and other responsibilities, you know. So I got really lucky there. But yeah, that question that when someone says, how long is it going to take me? It's like, well, how willing are you to sacrifice everything to go downwind? Or do you have the free time to do it, you know?
Yeah, can you put your life on hold for a month?
Yeah, Yeah. So yeah, for me, I had nothing better to do anyways. Missus was working and just see who's free and go paddle around. And then it only costs you like a bit of time in the middle of the day where no one else, most people are working. So for me, it was lucky.
Yeah.
And also you've got the factor of a lot of people don't want to suck all the time. So they will still go for the cheeky wing session here and there. Whereas the fastest way is actually just drop it.
I get that question a lot. And I'm sure, you know, I think it's important that you can foil before you jump into the downwind foiling. And like whether that's wing foiling or kite foiling or surf foiling, it doesn't matter too much. I think surf foiling is probably the best, but it's probably also the hardest to learn. But once you know how to foil, it does make the downwind journey a bit easier. But like you said earlier, there's a lot of people that are just learning like via downwind foil. And it's a hard slog, I would imagine. I've never done it myself because I didn't do it that way, but you only get one chance to learn it.
I always thought like downwinding is the sum of the parts. And if you can learn the parts separately, you can focus on them better. And then adding them together is a lot easier than learning them all in parallel. Because, you know, a beginner might go for a run, like a 3K run, but he can't paddle, can barely stand on his board. And once he's up, he doesn't know what to do. But then what does he focus on? Because he's not consistently getting on foil. But then he wastes all his energy focusing on the paddle or the balance. And then he gets up and he's knackered. And it's like, it's not an efficient use of your time. I think like there is something to be said for working smart when it comes to learning to downwind. And it's not if I work hard, I'll get there. You'll get there. But the question is, will your motivation drop so much by the time you get there that it's like that drawing of the guy digging a tunnel and then, you know, the diamond's on the other side and he turns around?
Yeah.
I think some people, they get to that point because it's so frustrating because they haven't thought about it, or they go in too light wind, or they rig too small on the foil,
or they go into too strong winds and it's too messy, you know, like
yeah, we had that as well. Like, so you've got like a growing crew here to set up like a WhatsApp community is great because you can like put subgroups for people to organize runs and you don't spam the main chat. So that was the attempt, at least. I think Dan's going to try it in WA. But yeah, then we had one day and I said to everyone, don't go in light wind. So then one day, like 35 knots, and I was like, oh no, this is going to be a nightmare as well. And then I think what happened was, because when it's that windy, on the bystanders, they get worried as well.
Yeah.
We've got one run and it runs perfectly next to a motorway.
Mm.
And you're foiling 50 meters next to the motorway, unless you cut into the lake, which is what I do. I cut out and then come back in. Kill a bunch of them. They went along the side of the motorway, falling in, getting up, falling in. They got greeted at the end by like three fire engines, two ambulances, five police cars. I was like, oh no.
Yes.
That too strong can also be pretty rough for beginners as well.
Yeah. There's not really an easy answer for that. Like the I guess civilians calling in, you know, people in stress, because like if you saw someone learning to downwind, like in those stronger winds, you'd think, what are they doing? And you watch them for a while and they're falling off, they're getting up, they're falling off, they're getting up. You probably think they are in trouble. Like if you think about it, what it is they're doing. And maybe every now and then they get up, but then you fully understand why it's called. And there's every chance that they could be in trouble. But I think like the international help is like, you know, waving your arms, right? And I think that's too late, because if you've knocked yourself out, waving your arms isn't going to help you. But like, if you can't do it. So it's like, it's a really hard one, because like you keep crying wolf and the emergency services are going to be like, oh no, not this again. But I think legally they have to go no matter what. Here in Australia, the helicopter gets called a fair bit, and there's like two sorts of helicopters. There's like a West, there's like the really big disaster one. And then there's like the guys that just go out because they're like training. You know, they'll go out and check it out anyway. And that one gets called on downwind foilers all the time, especially on weekends when you're going close to headlands, you know, when it's close to, there's no real easy answer. There's like here in Australia, we've got in New South Wales, there's a marine rescue app that the emergency service can see your intentions. But if you look like someone's called you in, it looks like you're in trouble, even if that was your intention, they're still going to go and check on you. So it's it's a tricky one.
Well, the funny one, the international distress signal, one of my mates, he went in light wind. His paddle up's not great. He's a big boy. I think he's almost 100 kilos, maybe a bit more. He's a power lifter. So heavy, heavy guy.
Yeah.
And light wind, couldn't get up. He's balancing on his board, and the Coast Guard, or the equivalent of the Coast Guard, but it's inland, come along and like, are you okay? He's like, yeah. He's like, put your paddle in the air if you're not okay. And then you got a wobble. like that to balance.
Yeah.
And then they came. But he ended up chatting them into giving him a toe up.
Oh, no way.
Then he toe foiled back to the finish. Don't know how he managed to get that.
That's one, some serious sweet talking. Yeah.
Yeah, but what we started doing, because what we did a run once, same with the same guy, but he was on the wing, where we crossed the lake in the Netherlands. Is like the IJsselmeer. It's like a 50 something kilometer lake. We did a 27 kilometer run starting in the middle to the top, because we never start on the ends because the fetch, right? So always make sure we got like 10K fetch. So we did this run, and the normal start, the wind was a bit weird. So we started in the village. There's a little harbor there. Then people saw us leave, and you know, an hour and a half later, they didn't see us come back. So then that was the only time I've had the chopper. We get to the finish and the chopper flies over. And I said to my mate, I bet you that's for us. Fuck. So then we waved, and the chopper actually came and landed, because I was wearing a massive, like a really bright high-vis jacket. I stopped on that day wearing high-vis. So they landed, and we told them what we'd done, and they were like, oh yeah, we're looking for you. No worries. All good. They called the command center. And then after that, we spoke to the command center, because it's strange, in the Netherlands, there's a group called the KNRM, and they're volunteers. So you definitely don't want to be having people call on you, because then these volunteers who are on standby have to leave their families or whatever. It's not like they're sitting in a station.
Waiting. Yeah.
No, it's like the Coast Guard, the helicopter, they're waiting. They don't mind. It's training. Yeah, it costs the state money. But actually the guys in the chopper, they quite enjoyed it. They thought it was great. But what annoyed me was there was also two other boats that came out from the KNRM, and those are volunteers. So we called around. And for that lake, I have the WhatsApp of the sort of the skipper of the KNRM, because they're posted all around the whole country. So if we do that crossing, I WhatsApp him and say, oh, we're going to do it. What we also do now is we will email the command center. So if someone calls 112, it goes to the Coast Guard and they deploy resources accordingly. So we always, if it's a big group or it's a long run or the conditions are a bit, you know, stronger, we'll call that, email them, give them what we're doing, start time, plan, finish time, who's on the run, give them all our phone numbers. And we also use a Coast Guard tracking app. Mm-hmm. And basically, the rule is if they call you, you answer. Even if it means compromising an ace, if that's what you're chasing, or a fast time, you get called, you answer. So I changed my phone. You know, you've got like do not disturb and all that. I've got one called downwind, and it silences all notifications except for certain numbers, one being the Coast Guard, one being the guy, and one being the missus, just in case.
Yeah.
And then my downwind buddies. So I know that if my phone rings, something's up. And normally I feel it, but I also downwind with the Shox headphones. So I'll always get the ringing.
Yeah.
And since that, I've personally not had any issues. Some other people have had, just still because the public see you, but that genuinely has helped a lot. We did a run actually, we were really far out to sea in the Coast Guard patrols. My buddy Sebrin was out there, came off foil, was having a rest. The boat came up to him. You okay? Yeah, no worries. And then they must have called into the headquarters and the control room, then called my buddy. He answered, and they were like, oh yeah, we see your other buddies 3 kilometers further downwind than you, and have fun. You know, so it really changes the relationship, and they appreciate it a lot more, being aware of our plans.
Well, I think like that communication is definitely the key, but it's like to get their numbers, you've got to have them like, you know, be called in the first place. So
that's the tricky thing, right?
Yeah. So as there's more and more downwind foilers, like unless you're sharing the numbers with the new crew that are coming up, then it's very difficult for them to know. And that's it's a tricky one.
We've got a WhatsApp group, the sort of like the safety protocol. We try to reinforce it every now and again. It's a bit knee jerk though, because like it goes quiet for a bit, and then one guy gets the whole thing called out, and then we do a little refresh. But it's getting there. And it's more on the lakes, on the North Sea. They're not as, it's harder for people to see you on the North Sea.
And it's interesting, like before you said you don't wear your high vis jacket anymore because it's easier for you to be seen. And I got a friend who's a lifeguard here, and he dresses in black every time he downwinds because he knows that the volunteer lifeguards in summer are just like, they're great, but they're looking for things to do, and they normally cause more harm than good. You know, like they're not actually that good at, they're volunteers basically. Like it's everywhere. Like you got the professionals, then you got the volunteers, and the volunteers look, they mean well, but like they're not the best equipped, I guess. And look, for a lifeguard, like a professional lifeguard, to be wearing black to avoid being seen because so many people have been called, it's like it's not the right way to be going about things, but it's out of the best interests of I'm going to be fine and don't call a helicopter or a boat on me. And it's like it's happening everywhere, it sounds like, you know. It's the communication need to open up, I guess.
I do wear high vis when I go on the North Sea, but that's because I tend to cut out 3Ks offshore. Like if someone can spot me from the beach 3Ks offshore, then I want them spotting me when I do longer runs.
Yeah, exactly.
It won't happen. And before, when I wasn't wearing high vis, I had a flare just in case.
Yeah. I think mobile phones, when I do longer runs, EPIRBs, are a good thing to have, I think, which is just an emergency service can look at you. Walkie talkies are a good one because there is I think here it's channel 16 that actually communicates with the life or the marine rescue.
So it's a bit tricky here because they like to put rules on things. So you got to have a license and to have one. So, and it's the same with the EPIRB. I've got one and I'm doing my, get my ticket to have it because it's a satellite communicator. But we're lucky here that along the whole stretch of coast is phone coverage, even 6Ks offshore. So I've never really had any issues with the phone. And what I do to save battery is I'll use Garmin live location instead of like WhatsApp, because then it doesn't use the GPS on your phone. Use the GPS of your watch.
That's a good tip.
Sends it like it syncs your emails or whatever. Uses pretty much no data.
Yeah.
But I haven't tried the group track. I want to try that. And then you can set it up with your buddies and maybe see them on your watch.
Well, I know a few guys do, like, I guess more on the, they use like water speed to like a live water speed. I guess that could work as well. There's so many, I guess the reason this is happening is like the downwind SUP guys, like, and I guess it never really took off as much as the downwind foiling has from what I can tell here in Australia. Like there was a scene, but it was like, especially in wild days, everyone would be in sort of the protected waterways and doing pretty short runs, but the foilers are doing longer runs, they're going further offshore, and there's maybe more of them. Like it's looking like there'll be more of them. I guess the downwind, like kayak guys, like there's obviously a lot of those, like surf ski, there's lots of those here. But I guess the learning curve is just so much harder on a foil. Yeah. Like there's more flailing, and you're standing up so you can be seen more. And when you're on foil, you're even higher again so you can be seen more. So it's interesting to see it happen all around the world, you know, all this safety protocols, I guess, going into it. But let's get back to like your journey and like less safety stuff. It was a good discussion on safety stuff, and I don't want to discount it, but I think I want to know more about you.
So I started on the lakes. The lakes we have are great. They're like 1 to 3 to 4 meters. That's the Markermere ones, the Isomere that's bigger. It's 5 to 6 meters roughly in the middle. And where I was living in the Netherlands before, I would be able to go to one part that had sort of the fetch go over the deepest part. And I had a seven, it was a 7K run. It was perfect.
Mm.
So I would go wing with my girlfriend up there, and then she'd pick me up at the bottom. It was a 12 minute drive. So like,
perfect.
For people that get their partners to shuttle them, low effort, high value shuttles are the ones. So minimal driving for the partner. And yeah, that's, don't have them waiting too long. I've done that, and you lose your credits pretty fast.
So yeah.
Don't mess it up for yourself if you've got a partner who's willing to shell for you. So don't when you want to try smaller foils, don't ask your partner to shell you. Do that with your buddies. Then at least your buddies can wait. Yeah, so I spent a decent amount of time on the lakes, downwinding up to 30 kilometers, just because I lived closer to the lakes than I did to the North Sea. But then went to the North Sea and kind of got my ass handed to me after like clean running 30 Ks on the North Sea, on the lakes for a while. And it wasn't actually to do with the speed of the bumps. It was more to do with just refraction.
Variability. People don't underestimate the variability, like the two different swells or three different swells. Like it's just that the patterns aren't clean anymore.
Yeah. We're lucky that we don't get groundswell thanks to the UK. And that's where our surf is so bad. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much always wind swell. But I didn't understand the effect that like a depth change has on refraction. And like the North Sea itself is shallow. I think looking at where we would be within reason, the deepest part is like 16 meters. And within the first kilometer of shore, it's 3 to 4 meters deep. So going from 16 to 3 to 4 in like a fairly quick step, even if you've got side offshore wind here, you've still got waves coming straight at the beach because it's far enough out that they'll start to bend.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so like, once we figured that out, then the North Sea became fine. But it's just like you paddle out and you've got bumps pushing against you and maybe very tiny wind chop, but it's not paddleable really going sideways. Then all of a sudden you cross that depth change and then
it all opens up.
And it's all in one straight line and it's perfect. And then you've got current going one way up the coast when it's coming up and the other way when it's going down. So also made the mistake of going current with wind a few times and that was horrible.
How obvious is that for you? Because here we get current and it's usually tidal, but sometimes it is like, it's bigger than tides. It's like ocean currents. They sort of move in like the East Australian current will sometimes come in close enough to shore that it'll, close enough to where you're downwinding that it's like it will affect it.
Yeah.
Whereas
I've never really noticed the current too much unless I'm like on the edge of my foil's range. So if I have like a small foil for the wind and the current's with me, then I'll feel like, oh, this is terrible. But if I've got a big foil and the current's with me, then I'll be going really fast. Like that's how I did a 210 with the Spitfire 960. And I was like, how on earth is this possible? It's because I was so overfoiled. Plus I had a strong current with me. I think it just being full moon. And then the other way around is like, I went with the 770 in 14 knots, but I had really strong current against. So it really, like I only notice it, the benefits when I'm on the thresholds of each foils. Like if I'm overfoiled or underfoiled, for like conventionally what the bumps would be, then I'll notice impact of the current. But if I'm like comfortably sized, then it's not that strong that you think, oh yeah, it's not like Hood River where you can sometimes even just be stationary if you're just managing your pitch and not stall.
Cool. So, yeah.
And then, So I moved over to the North Sea. That was really challenging, but you know, got there eventually and then went to Hood River. And that was like a sort of booster to transition to smaller foils because the paddle up's so easy there.
Mm-hmm. North Sea and lakes, I guess, do you find the fresh water versus the salt water was a big difference or nothing?
No, not really. I've seen some posts recently about that, but I don't really notice the difference that much. Not with my flat water paddle ups. But then again, I haven't tried to flat water paddle up smaller foils on salt water. And I think that's something like when you see people flat water you know, if you've got a big foil, it doesn't really matter what you're in, because the density is so difference is so small compared to the lift that you're getting for a big foil.
Yeah, but if you go on the edge.
Yeah. So I've not tried to flat water start the 770 on salt water yet. So maybe I'll notice it then. It was about 30.
What about, I guess you haven't got into your equipment, but what about boards? Like what volume boards are you using for your weight, I guess is the...
Yeah. So the first board was that wing board. That was 110 liters. Then I got a 6'4 by 24 that my brother made me, like a copy of the E3. That was 105. Then I went 6'6 by 21, 100 liters that I still use on the lakes because really tight bumps. I don't like long boards because, you know, like you nudge into the bump in front of you and then your board pushes one way. So I just like a little board and it tips in nice. And then,
and I guess to add to that, you're probably using a bigger foil in a lake, so the paddle up's easier.
Yeah. Though I have paddle up. No, generally you do use bigger boards. Yeah. And then I got into the whole, I got into riding for Apertree. So I had a 7.2 by 21 100 liter prototype and then moved to the 7.7 by 20 110 stock size just for like refinement of dims. It's nice to ride a stock size, and then as you tweak the shape you keep riding the same dims to validate the changes. Like I wanted a bit narrower. So now I am riding my own dim, so like 7.7 by 19.105. I don't actually want to go any narrower because like I like my stance offset. I have ridden narrower boards and I'm like, oh, where do I put my toes or where do I put my heel? And your toes are creeping over the edge. And I was like, our bombs aren't so difficult that we need narrow boards here. You know, the North Sea itself, on a good day, you might get 6 second period if it's blown for like 2 days straight. So it's still pretty close together.
Yeah, it's on that. I find the difference between like, you know, anything under 20, like I've got a board that's as narrow as 15 and I kind of just use it for flat water. But anything under 20, like 20 to 17, I don't find is that big a jump. Like even 16 and a half, I've got a 16 and three quarters, I guess, that's pretty manageable. Like, but once you go like 20, like when you change from 20 to like 22, it's, I notice a much bigger difference there, not only in stability, but in board speed. So going narrower than 20, I think as long as you can stand on a 20 wide, you can probably stand on a 17 wide, like for stability wise, because you're kind of relying on the foil at that point. Going bigger than 20, I find, or maybe 21, but like over that sort of 20, 21, I find the stability is a lot better, but the drag is a lot higher.
That's
so it's this balancing act, and it's always
you're skipping on that paddle up. It's like every time you're like, oh
yeah, you feel sticking. Yeah. So it's like
feel it more.
I feel like the widest I'd ever recommend anyone, like for the biggest person, would be 25. But like for me to paddle up a 25 wide board is much, much, much harder than even 20.
But then even oil's harder to paddle up like that. I did that coaching camp in Tenerife and one of the guys like, oh, do you mind trying my setup that the mass in the right placing with the axis 1300. I mean, okay. He's a really big, like big guy, tall and pretty strong as well and heavier. So for him, it's not he doesn't really notice the drag lift trade-off. But for me, I was like, whoa, I'm used to paddling up the smaller foils and there's a way less drag in the system. So I noticed like with wider boards, but also with bigger
foils. It's like you've got to pump harder. Like it's more of a this pump, whereas a whoop, with a small foil. So 7.7 19 is what you're currently using.
19, yeah. I'm pretty happy with that. Maybe I'd go a little narrower, but. I haven't really felt the need to so that's what I'm writing now.
The only thing I'll add to that is when you do go narrower, it's hard to go back to wider, you know, because
Yeah, I did notice that. Like, I tried Greg's board in France, and it's 16.8. It was with the 1075, but it was like so easy to pedal up. And then I went on mine. I was like, oh, this is an adjustment again.
Yeah.
It's just like you have to just add more strokes into your habits, I guess.
Yeah, it's it's just you use an older board, and it's like, man, how did I ever use that? You know, because your new boards are so much more refined, basically. It's the
got the same with stabs as well. Like, once I start downsizing stabs and getting used to smaller stabs, and you go back to bigger ones, you're like, oh, that feels a bit slow.
Yeah, sluggish, draggy, harder to pump almost. Yeah.
Yeah, I had the, before like my first codes were the 980 and 770, and I only had the 142 and the 150 AR stabs.
Yeah.
Because the R stabs are still coming. I used the 142. I loved it. And then got the 135. I was like, definitely prefer that. And then at the weekend, I was chatting to Dan about like, oh, you know, what about negative shearing the 142? Compare that to the 135. Will the low aspect have more, you know, like squirt? And I know that, I don't know the term we were talking about. And he's like, yeah, some guys call it squirt. I was like, okay, squirt when you pump.
Cool.
And that's, I did the back-to-back test. And I was like, nah. Gotta stay on the 135 now. Can't use the 142.
Yeah, Dan.
I think it has Dan, surf.
Different people like different things, and Dan's always, you know, because I've worked with Dan for like the last year, but he's always liked the bigger tails. Like he's downwinded like with the 188 or the 175. And I like he's like, it just it's easy. He talks about the sink rate. Like he can just stay up really high on his mast and he's able to stay there. But I'm like, yeah, but what if you need to pump? Like it's just got like, I feel even like surf foiling with it, like you've got to be super maxed to be able to pump that thing. And it's hard to move. And I use it most of the time to tow foil so that I can't link waves, you know, make it so it's like slow and draggy so I can stay in the pocket. But it's,
I think for the surf, I'm definitely still going to use the 142. But yeah, for downwinding, 135 for sure.
Yeah, they've got to start in the lake, fence the North Sea, had a few issues with the North Sea because of the depth and the short, I guess, the multiple angles.
Yeah. But then, that kind of clicked and then started to try and go longer and longer.
Yeah. And
in view of Maui, so.
Yeah. What's the longest run you've done so far?
55 kilometers. That was my second day on the 980.
Nice. And so that was in the North Sea.
Yeah, that was from a spot called Vaganze up to the top to Julianadorp or Den Helder. I would like to one day do the whole thing, but we've got the port of Amsterdam comes out in the middle. So got to figure out.
Maybe an escort or a ninja outfit.
Yeah. Well, it's more the super tankers. I think even if you're dressed in high vis with three flares strapped to your back, they couldn't avoid you anyways.
No.
And they're fast.
Yeah, it's a serious port, that one. You want to make sure you've got clearance, so to speak.
But luckily, it splits the country in two. So you've got 55 Ks above, and there's a 60 K option from the south to finish on the south side of that channel. So I still need to do that. But that one's a bit more annoying wind angle wise because the coast does like a massive curve. So you've got to start either with flatter conditions with side offshore wind, which is better for the second half, or you start with
onshore wind,
and then you have to cut really hard for the second half. So I reckon the offshore start with a 960 or 860 flat water paddle up, pump out, and then cruise the second half is the more favorable one.
That's what I'd recommend. What I
I've done that run minus 13 K, so like 45, 50-ish. The first half is like, the bumps are small. I don't know what it is. It's maybe it's due with the coast. And then you start at Scheveningen. It's like a well-known surf spot. So you get, if it's busy, you get looked at because you're going out with subfoils in the surf spot, but that's not really a big deal. So you go out and the bumps are small and then you go and then 10Ks, the bumps just go boom. Like it's really interesting. I haven't looked at the depth charts, but.
Yeah, depth plays a huge factor. Like even here in Sydney, there's like the eastern suburbs run and then the northern beaches run. And even the angle of the coast is quite different. So eastern suburbs, you need more like south with a bit of west in it. and like the northeast run is much straighter there. So southwest and northeast is better eastern suburbs. Yeah. And but for us, southeast is not too bad, but like south to southeast, and then the northeast run is kind of a little bit onshore. So it's like, depending on the wind angle, there'll be different sections that are better or cleaner, but then also currents and cliffs and depth. Like depth is huge. It makes more of an impact than we know, I think, or that we...
We have one bit like Zandvoort, you know, the F1 course, there's like the F1 racetrack there. That part of the beach, it's like really shallow for really far out. So when you're foiling through there, it can be horrible if the current's with you, because like the current then goes faster. With the currents against, it's like a Hood River section for
yeah,
1.5 to 2 kilometers, because it's just like shallow water. The depth suddenly goes shallow, so like all the bumps filter and sort organize themselves. So you just have like line current against. It's pretty nice, but
It's
North Sea is fun because it changes all the time, and I don't try and pick the best current or whatever. I just like to just see what comes. Those are the stretches that I do between that top 50K and the bottom 45. They're the closest to me. And actually the downwind economics are pretty good. Like the driving time is not too far.
Yeah. Important.
It just saves a lot of time. That's kind of my downwind journey, I guess. And now it's just sprinkling in a bit of racing.
I wanted the stuff in Barcelona.
Barcelona. So yeah, that was my second race. I did Open de France last year, and I made all the same mistakes again this year. So for France, I didn't ride I was riding for Axis then. I didn't ride the Arc Pros before the racing because I was always downwinding the Spitfires, and then decided to race on the Arc Pros. This time round, I had switched to Code, but the RF foils were still on the way. So I hadn't used them other than the 770 and flat water starting the 860 and the 960. So that was probably the first mistake, familiarity.
Mm-hmm.
Good thing is that they're very easy to foil. So like on foil, not really a problem at all. And so that was my first prep mistake. And then on the day... Yeah, day one, I'm sure it was on social media, and I think you mentioned it on Thursday Thoughts. The wind wasn't on. It was on in the morning.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where the group thing starts to come in, because a bunch of the guys, they went out to go have a look at the Ineos Grenadier boat that had been put in the water and was out. And the America's Cup boat, they came back. Yeah, bumps are decent, whatever, you know. And then... I said to Dan, what are you going to run? He goes, 860 should go. I was like, yeah, okay. Greg took the 860, but I forgot that Greg takes the 860 and everything. And like, he's really dialed into the 860-135 combo.
Yeah.
Anyways, I'm like, convinced myself, even though I'd said, if it's light, I'll take the 960. And it was forecast to drop, but everyone, I don't know, we all just convinced ourselves.
Yeah, you get it. It's a great mentality. It's going to be good. It's going to be good.
Lucas made the perfect call. So, yes, we all drive out on the boats. We're thinking, this is all right. And then, like, probably the last K starts to die off. And then we, like, start rigging up, like, screwing all our stuff together on the boats. We're like, oh, no, this is going to be a slow.
Yeah.
So
can you just talk us through that? So like the race in Barcelona, you literally got boats out, like the shuttle was onshore. So it was.
Yeah. So the normal winds there this time of the year are southeasterly. And it's normally beautiful weather, sunshine, warm. Then you get a thermal boost in the afternoon. And the forecast just didn't come in for us. And we got, and they'd had rain that whole week, and it was on and off rain. And then we had east winds, which is full onshore. So on day one, we had that east wind in the morning and a groundswell coming from the south. So like pretty much just like the wind bumps are going, this way. And like a decent groundswell. Which was pretty hectic. And we went straight upwind with the boats, probably like 8 kilometers. Everything disassembled, because there was 28 of us across 4 or 5 boats. So anywhere between 5 and 7 people per boat. And then assemble everything in the water. Start sequence was nice and clear. So 2 boats, start line, flag up 2 minutes out, flag down, go.
Seated start, standing start.
Seated start, yeah.
Yeah, so gun goes, stand up, paddle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I'm a fan of.
I think it's the easiest to police, like to make it fair. Yeah.
Yeah. So some people then get on their knees early. You know, is that seated? I think there should be feet in the water. But
yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
So it's minor. It's easier to police and at least have everyone in the right place as well.
Mm.
So yeah, seed start, gun goes, everyone gets up, everyone just can't pop up. Okay, Clement just goes.
Yeah, Clement. It was Chad.
Clement, Tom as well. Tom and Clement were gone. And then Greg, Lucas.
What was Tom and Clement using? I think Clement was on the starboard new one.
Yeah, I think it was posted yesterday. It was it's like the X15 foil that for the racing class.
Yeah.
Wing class. Wing racing.
Yeah, right. So he's downwind following a wing racing foil.
Yeah, it was H20, I believe. And then Tom had the 860, I believe, on his Phantom mast.
Okay. Yeah.
And then Greg is 860. And then Lucas was on the 1201. Can't remember what the other guys were. Oh, yeah. Romu, the guy from Guadeloupe. He was on the Armstrong 755, though he reckons he would have wanted the 930, but like he paddled that up.
755 is similar to the 860 because that's what Oscar used for Molokai.
Oh, yeah,
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, that's 750. Yeah, because him and I were like same speed across the channel. It was a bit quicker.
Yeah,
so slightly quicker than the 860.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, everyone, even the guys that did go, I think they would have rather have smaller foils, a bigger foil, sorry.
Bigger foils, yeah.
I had a bit of a nightmare popping up, and then you pop up, and then you're just like pumping. And because you don't want to tap into the groundswell, because it's only 8Ks out, the groundswell will make you miss the finish because we went straight upwind. So you really couldn't.
Should have done a little more, like 45 degrees, I guess, upswing.
But it's a, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's if you were to do it for fun, but for a race, I think it was a good course, from the sense that the best man will always win, right?
Yeah.
On the day. So I had a bit of pumping, and then I was like to myself, this is a 2-day event on one of my rests. And I saw a whole bunch of people like way further down climbing into the boat. So I was like, oh, they're going to get in the boat. I'll just save my legs.
In front of you. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I'll just save my legs. Yeah. So I will put my hand up and say I did get out earlier to save energy, but I was like, it's a 2-day thing and they're not penalizing when you get out. So, you know, if you get out 4Ks down and you get a DNF or you get out 2Ks down because you see everyone getting out after pumping their lungs out, then, you know, maybe that's something for later, because if it's a multi-day campaign, it's effectively you're treating it like a throwaway.
Yeah.
But that you can still get a position because you've seen that 90% or more of the fleet are doing it doesn't impact you too much. So it was a bit of just like, I don't want to slog the rest of the way.
Yeah.
So I did get out earlier.
And how many of the 28 got out early?
20 didn't finish. The worst bit is some guys made it to like pretty close. And then they still got in the boat. So I was like, well, you wasted all that energy.
Yeah. Right.
Dan, to his credit, like just paddled the last bit on his knees.
Yeah.
To get a time across.
Yeah.
So it was.
It's traveled too far.
Yeah, exactly. Then you're committed. So yeah, 20 people didn't finish out of the 28. It was light. Like,
yeah.
Really light. So that was some sort of comfort knowing that you weren't the only one that.
Yeah.
Sort of threw the towel in.
Yeah. Tough conditions. It just shows how tough the conditions are, you know, like that's.
Yeah. And it's weird. It's like the 860, you can flat water start, but it's.
Yeah, when it's still tough. In it, you know, it's still in that sort of bathtub thing. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a two, leftover wind bombs that are dying by the minute, and south swell coming through. So yeah. And then day two, we had the same wind, but way stronger, let's say like 15 knots. And then we got out in time. I mean, the wind did start to die off, but we got out in time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this time we were allowed to take two foils, which was a good call.
Yeah. It probably didn't happen as much that day.
No, yeah. Most of us decided to rig big anyway. Like we were talking, me and Dad were talking after, and he goes, "That was stupid, eh?" I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "We were riding this 960 yesterday in like nothing and going for ages behind the boat with Javi." And he goes, "Yeah. And you know, Bongi always says go jacked."
Yeah.
I don't know why I did.
And I was like, yeah, it was in the
message, you know?
Yeah.
So it's funny just how you get sucked in. You see one guy do it and you're like, oh, I need to do the same, especially on a short course where speed is more important than
efficiency.
Than efficiency. Over a long course, efficiency wins, but over a short course, you know, then the speed does start to matter.
But also one mistake on a short course is bigger than a mistake, you know. So it's this, you know, one fall is slower than, like, if you know you're going to come down from, you know, cardio or, you know, heart rate issues, you actually, like, you don't actually gain, like, I think with code, the gaps are pretty small, you know, like 770 to 860, 860 to 960. It's not, like, I feel like 770 is most comfortable for me at, like, between 210 and 220. And then the 860 is like 220 to 230. And then the 960 is like, you know, 240 to 235 to 245. And, you know, you're kind of like, you're not making like 10 seconds a kilometer over 8Ks is, you know, it's 80 seconds.
Yeah.
And that's one fall.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I would even go as far as to say you could go for a quiver with a 770 and a 960.
Yeah. For sure.
You could even omit the 860.
Yeah.
If you wanted a 2-foil quiver, you go 860. If you want without the 860, if you wanted a 1-foil quiver, you just take the 860.
Yeah.
So, yeah. The overlap's good. So then over talking about time lost with falls takes us to day two. So better foil, better wind, better bumps, like really good bumps, actually really nice wind bumps, just no south swell. So just proper, nice stacked steep wind bumps.
Mm-hmm.
At the 960 with the 135. I think Dan had the 1075 with a big stab. And Hugh had the 960, but then with a 158 AR, or maybe even the 178.
Big
stab.
I hate that. This time, I don't like downwinding with the big tail, personally, but each to their own.
It's not my thing, but it worked for him.
Yeah.
So this time I was like, okay, I'm not going to rush anything. So actually I sat behind Tom at the start. I was like, I'm going to not, I wanted a free runway for when I did pop up. So I thought if I sat behind Tom or Clement, that would be the best call. Clement went to the other side of the line. I'm not going to go sit behind him because I got paddled there.
So yeah.
Tom was there, sit behind him.
Yeah.
And I was waiting, the flag went and I watched him and I was like, oh, wow. He's not like jumping to his feet really fast. And he just kind of got to his feet really calm and collectively and then just went. So I was like, oh, so then I did the same. And then you don't have the like the missed strokes or the wobbles. So that was another thing I learned, you know, yes, it's a race, but if you jump to your feet really fast and just stick the paddle in, you'll probably just fall.
Mm.
That happened to the guys either side of me. So I got up really slowly. Tom went, then a bump came and then I went. So then, yeah, Tom and Clement at the front. And then Romu was ahead of me. And then I didn't really see anyone else. So I was got a bit excited. So I started to push past Romu, got into third, was frothing at this point. I was like, oh, sweet. I'm going quick. And then I was like, ah, let's push even harder. I should not have pushed harder. I should have just relaxed. Actually, I should have sat behind Romu because he's really experienced and he's a really good foiler and just followed his line. But me being me again, carried away, just kept pushing. I was trying to up and over everything. And that's where the 960 kind of maybe was the wrong call, but it was also the right call. because, you know, got up quick with it. So up and over, made a mistake, fell. Like 10 people passed me.
Yeah.
Got up, paddled up again. Of the 10, I probably closed down 5-6 of them. Yeah, decent number. Like my on-foil pace was good. Like I looked back and I was like, everything on foil was 228 to 230. Right. So, and then a lot of the guys, well, so then I was going again, and then the backwash kept getting worse and worse because the more wind, the better bumps, but also the worse the backwash.
Yes, the backwash.
Yeah. Straight on harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Me being me, I didn't really think about that at the time, but it was obvious. Like I started to drift right on the bumps, whereas I should have drifted left, because going left, you're going more harbor entrance, whereas opening, less backwash. Anyway, so I kind of took the right eye. The backwash got worse, and I just kept trying to pump through everything. And the backwash made it a bit messy. And yeah, so I made a pretty stupid mistake pumping through, came down on foil, and then just boom, 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 the next guy, the next guy, the next guy. And all these guys were just cruising, like going really mellow. And I was like, shit, if I just foiled more mellow,
yeah, I
would have just foiled through to the finish. So there's 1K out from the finish line, and then another guy fell next to me, and he goes, yeah, I'm not going to paddle. Just went in on his knees, and I was like, stubborn, so I'm going to try to paddle up. And then in your head, you're panicking, like, I need to get up. I didn't compose myself, and then I was like, oh, I should probably just follow him, and then went in on my knees. But yeah.
And so was it a finish at the harbor entrance, or was it a finish sort of around that corner?
No, it was at the harbor entrance. There was like a pole and then a boat.
Yeah.
So we didn't have to be around the corner. But yeah, so that was the learning there. You know, foiling slower but not foiling is still faster than foiling fast.
And foiling, yeah.
Yeah. But I think also, so that's the number one thing, but also two, knowing the speed range of your foil.
Yeah, which you went in a bit blind.
Fast you can push the foil for your up and overs helps. But then also, yeah, I don't know. Pretty much just was my greediness to push.
That's the competitiveness, no? You know, that's what racing, that's why we do races, because it pushes us that extra level, and you understand how you...
It was amazing how casually the guys that were coming in were just, well, I was like, why did I just do that? Just cruise it. Because it's not the first time I foiled in backwash. So it was just a combination of like pushing too hard and backwash.
Mm-hmm.
It just made it horrible. So yeah.
So,
but it was good. A good race.
And was Clement like far and away ahead of everyone, or was Tom giving him a run for his money?
Tom was on the 1075 on the second day. Like he must have been jacked, because Dan was like, I couldn't turn. I was so locked in, just like going straight on the bumps. I think Tom was in the lead actually for the first half of the race.
Uh-huh.
And Clement just hipped him at the last bit.
Uh-huh.
But I was too far away to see.
and did Tom not finish on day one?
Yeah, I think so. I think Tom was ahead as well. But then one of the boats accidentally, like the lead boat, cut across him, like messed his line up, and then he came off foil. And that is frustrating when that happens. But I guess at the same time, okay, in this case, it was a boat from the race organization, but in the same vein, it could have also just been a member of the public coming by. So it's difficult for the organizers as well.
Did he come off foil and not finish?
No, he didn't finish. I don't know. I don't know if that was conscious choice, just because he was like, it's done. Or I think that was it. I think Tom can paddle up the 860 fairly easily. So I think he was just frustrated with the
very French of
him. I didn't speak to him too much about it, but I can understand being frustrated by it.
Yeah, for sure.
Especially with the the impact that it has on your overall position.
Yeah, because in the podium for the overall two races was Clément first, Greg second, and Lucas third. Yeah. So it sounds like Tom was kind of battling for Clément for first overall, but he...
Yeah. I wonder if he'd finished, if he'd then had the second spot.
Yeah. He would have, but surely, if he was in the race of first on day one and the race of first on day two.
Yeah.
So...
I guess that's also part of racing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, being the first one, it probably wasn't, you know, the placings are interesting, but it doesn't have the prestige or it's starting out. So it's not like, it's still important, but it's not as important as, you know, like a Molokai tie that's been around for a little bit longer.
And I think also, like, for Xavi, it was really well organized. It was cool to be part of a bigger event. It was part of like the biggest Euro.
Yeah, the Euro Tour Stop Race. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was huge. There was loads of people, loads of races. The vibe was good. And Xavi adapted to the conditions well. There was a bit of discussion about, do we go to a point system or that? But we agreed as a collective, you can't change the rules midway through an event. And actually, another thing that came out of this event was because Amaury, the organizer of Open de France, was there as well. And it was Greg's idea, I think. We should just come up with you would say it's a rule book, but, you know, in sailing, they have guidelines for racing, like for moth racing. So you come up with like a set of guidelines for running a race. You know, how do you do scoring? How do you do your start sequence? And then you can get some consistency.
Yeah.
And then just involve all the people that are organizing races.
Get feedback and go from there.
Yeah. And then you can have it universal. But then the other thing we said is, well, you should also have when you sign your waiver to enter a race, you should also sign that you agree to abide by the rules of the race, which are also published. And if you don't, the organizer has the right to just say, well, this guy's being a dick. I put loads of effort in. Take a hike.
Yeah.
Okay, it's early days in racing still, so there's obviously loads of questions and loads of, you know, everyone has an opinion, right? But at the same time, you've got to respect the fact that these organizers have sacrificed a lot of time, effort, and energy, and they're everything is best intent. Everything is done with best intentions. No one's trying to catch you out or snake you. So I think one thing that would help is if rules get published in advance, or agreed on in advance, but then also competitors have to agree and sign that they agree.
Yeah, they need to be circulated. A lot of the times, rules aren't even released until, you know, people don't look at the rules until the day of the race. But if you sign, you read it then and make people know that you read the rules. These are the rules, and that's what you're signing for.
I think that's an important part of racing, because otherwise you have gray areas and people contest, or, you know, it can lead to unpleasant encounters with people. It's just passion, right? Passion,
yeah, it is.
Frustration. And if you can do anything or everything you can to avoid it, just by having published documents or agreed documents or guidelines or something that everyone sort of has
pitched on the same page.
You know, because Europe has the potential to have like a European tour. You know, we've got so many good places to do it, and maybe that's something that can happen in the future. But
the first
start would be to collectively guidelines. Work on guidelines. Yeah, I wouldn't say rules. You know, guidelines is better, that then each event can tweak or adapt to their own event as required.
Yeah, I think there needs to be some adaptation, because, you know, different locations are going to have, like, you know, even the question of whether it's a deep water finish or a beach finish. Like, personally, I think a deep water finish is better, because it's a foil race, not a running race. But, and damage of equipment and, you know, but it's up to the organizers. And if for the fans, they want the running finish, that's totally up to the organization. You know, they've put it together. And like, so if a Paddlemoor was a running finish, I didn't read the rules, because I didn't know it was a running finish, because we stopped at the markers, and then everyone's like, you got to run, you got to, like, what? So you had to run up. Yeah. And because Edo wasn't officially entered, he'd come in first. And he was just sitting on his board. So I was going to go paddle over to him and chat to him. And he's like, you better go, man. He's like, you got to finish.
So I think that's important as well, like early communication of rules.
Yeah, that was probably my bad. I was juggling a bit and didn't really, I missed the first part of the race briefing, you know, so it's like, well, that's my fault. But, you know,
But you have it shared before the race briefing. You also save a lot of the last minute. Oh, what about this? What about that? What about this?
Yeah.
Because you also, most of the time people ask these questions amongst themselves. So even if not everyone's read the rules, someone will have, a few people have. And then already amongst themselves, people can sort it. And then the race organizer doesn't get a million questions that could already be easily answered.
Yeah.
So I think that's definitely one thing that can be done in racing to make everything smoother.
Yeah. Well, speaking of racing, tell us what your plans are for the rest of the year.
Yeah. So going to be going to Maui to do the Triple Crown, or take part in the Triple Crown, should I say, Imua, M2M and M2O. So, unfortunately coming into the no wind season here as well. So going to be doing a lot of pumping around and flat water starting to keep the legs good.
Yeah.
And then after that, Open de France. And there's actually a race in Belgium on the 28th of September. So for everyone in Europe, it's called the Belgian North Sea Downwind Challenge. It used to be a surf ski race. Uh-huh. And then SUPs joined. And then now foils are going to be allowed to be in it this year.
Cool.
28th of September. I think registration opens a couple weeks beforehand. So I'll probably check something on my Instagram as well when it opens up. It would be cool to see.
Yeah, for sure.
And I also want to head over to Germany. There's some good downwinding in Germany.
In the north?
Yeah, in the north. It's like, it's not the North Sea, but it's not a lake. It's like a semi-closed body of water, like a fjord. So there's a couple guys sending some pretty nice runs up there.
So I've done a SUP race. It was part of the ACP World Tour back in the day. I can't remember the name at the moment, but
On the Baltic Sea.
Yeah, I think it was the Baltic, yeah. The day before was wild ocean, and it was an epic. It would have been an epic downwinder. We were actually, like, on our SUPs, we were talking about, you know, organizing to do a downwinder because you could see land on the, like, I guess it was upwind, so I guess it wasn't that big a body of water. But, yeah, it was, can't remember where it was. Charbois, I think it was. But anyway, there's definitely, but that's a cool thing. You can do downwind anywhere.
Yeah. And there's like a pretty solid scene of guys dotted around Europe now. So yeah, next to racing, I'd like to just go see other spots in Europe. Go up to Scandinavia, to the colder water. Sweden, Denmark. But yeah, main focus at the moment is Maui.
Yeah. And what are your aspirations? Like, what are you just competing, or do you want to, like, you know, I feel like the, you know, a lot of the French guys don't seem to come over. Like, I guess, or the European crew don't go to Hawaii. Like, there seems to be like more, there are more Europeans doing the Open of France than, you know, M2A, which obviously, same as there's more Aussies that do Aussie races than go to Molokai. It's just like travel. Yeah. What are you hoping for?
Yeah. I mean, so there's, the thing with Maui is it's just the cost. It's cost and time. So I'm lucky with on the time front, I got heaps of time off still from work. Yeah. And the cost, it's just, I think a lot of people don't, it's just a lot to spend. I put some money aside last year because I knew that I wanted to do this. But unless you're consciously doing that, then and then goals wise, you know, I had a good chat with Josh about this a while ago. The first time was just to take it in, take in the whole experience. hopefully put together a clean run at all the races. And then the pace will be what it is, you know, like I'm really going to race myself. Cause that's the other thing I realized in Barcelona. Sorry, can you hear my dog? She's like,
that's all right. Yeah.
No. In Barcelona, I was like, yeah, okay, you can race everyone and be really fast. But if you mess up, then it doesn't matter how fast you're going. So really, it's a race against yourself first. Mm-hmm. And if your race is good, then if you're fast, you're fast.
Yeah.
And then you see where you come.
Yeah.
So
I think that's like the best that you can do. Like the best race you can put together is not based on what someone else does, but based on what you do.
Yeah. Because you know, like when I saw you guys that all cruised past me when I was there, you know, their best kilometer is like 245, 250, 255. And I looked at mine, I was like 230, 228, 230, 228. And I was like, cool. Yeah. So really, it was just my lack of composure. So for me, like I'm going to treat it as like a time trial. And Josh also said to me, like, this is good that you've made this mistake here, because when you're in Maui, you're going to see guys on stupidly small foils.
Yeah.
Who have obviously got different goals. So now you don't get distracted by that. So
sure.
Yeah.
It's
just a clean run and then see where I go. Like, it's nice to also just, it's a good benchmark. You know, it's a stacked field. There's no bad foilers on that list.
Yeah. So, and especially with the course change, you know, being starting the bumps, finishing the bumps, more or less, it's your mistakes are going to be compounded, I guess, you know, because like, whereas I guess for me, Molokai last year, I made a mistake, probably the best place to make a mistake, because it was, everyone was coming off foil there and it wasn't even a mistake to come off foil. It was just flat water and headwind. So, you know, whilst in my head at the time, it was like, this is the worst mistake I can make. In hindsight, it was probably the best mistake I could make, because I had once I got up again, I had someone to aim for. And when when you're aiming for something, it makes it a hard, I think it's a harder race to win, you know, or to do well at, because a mistake is going to be worse than, you know, start in the flat and finish in the flat.
Mm. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Clean race, and just to be happy with my performances is what I'm going for. And then enjoy Maui. So from a race perspective, I'm arriving at the worst time. I arrived 2 days before Paddler Move On.
Yeah.
But I was like, do I want to have more of my trip after the racing or before the racing? And before the racing, you can prep better and get used to how fast the bumps are, especially for me. Like, there'll be a huge change in speed.
Yeah.
But then you're always thinking about the racing.
Exactly. I was just chatting with my wife about this. She goes, every time we go to Hawaii, it's like 3 weeks before the race or 2 weeks before the race, and then we leave the day after.
Yeah.
Can we compromise and do like a week before the race and then have like a week after? So it's like you can just holiday and not focus on, but like I love the challenge.
Yeah. And I was chatting to Fred Bonnef at Open de France last year, and he's a legend, right? Super nice guy. And he was like, yeah, I was just loving Maui so much that I just downwinded all the time before. And then he was knackered for M2O.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was like, I'm not going to be at the front of the pack. So do I need to recce the course? No. Do I need to make sure that my foiling is good so that if I get some hectic conditions that I'm not used to, that I can adapt with them, but I'm not too worried about speed. So from terms of following the right line at the finish, everyone converges. So as long as I can foil decently, I'll have some sort of people to follow, was my thinking, my logic for all the races. And then I can go on a foil bender after the racing and do like a million Galica runs a day if I want to. So that was my thinking, to just go really just enjoy being there. And not that I'm not going to enjoy M2O, but for me, the enjoyment will come out of putting together a good run.
And that's good goals to have. I think that's important. Yeah. It's we're not racing for sheep stations. You know, it's for fun. And it's cool to see where everyone's at, and you know, that's what it comes down to. So it's, yeah, I think it's
super. It's not often that people from all around the world converge on one place to Downwind.
Yeah.
And this is one of those events that does have the pull to get people from everywhere. And I think that's really cool. There's something to be said about that.
Yeah. I think the Open de France is, you know, from last year's event, I was like, people asked me, I was going like, it's its first year. I'm going to see how it sort of plays out. And had a bunch of stuff on at home. It was just like, I could have gone, but I'd just been away somewhere else. But this year I'm not going to be able to go again because it's a similar thing, but I want to get there one day. You know, it's one of those, like there's going to be more events like that.
I think it's going to be really good this year. I think there'll be a solid wait list for sure. Yeah. I don't even know when the entries are opening. I'm checking regularly, but it's going to be a really good one. And they're going to combine it with surf foiling and bump foiling.
Epic. So
discipline. Yeah, there's a multi-discipline title as well for anyone who wants to take on all three.
Yes.
Oscar with his pump legs will probably have a shot.
Oh, for sure. But then Gage, Dylan, if he's from New Zealand.
It'll be cool to see him all comes over.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, there's just more and more people that are getting better and better at everything. So that's someone asked me the other day, like, are you doing World Cup? Yeah, going over. How do you think you'll go? I'm like, I think a top 10 finish should be good. They're like, didn't you win last year? I'm like, yeah, it's getting busier. Like, more, there's so many kids that are doing it, and like, everyone's going so well. Even last year, like I said, if I can get top 10 last year, I was like stoked. And it's kind of still. You know, it's anyone's, and everyone's so close now that I think, you know, M2M, M2O, Palomua, there's every chance there'll be different winners, you know, and that's cool. It's good. It's healthy for the sport.
Yeah. I wonder if they'll do total time across all three or if they'll do like a point system.
Well, they need to publish it, don't they?
Yeah, there we go.
They need to publish the rules. We should, I'll reach out. What are the guidelines for this triple crown? You know, is it time or what do you think's the best? Like, what's your view?
I think I was talking to Greg about this. Because it's racing and we're looking at speed, time is best. Because, like, what if, okay, in Mua, there won't be a big gap between people. But, like, say you make a mistake on M2M and you lose, like, 2 minutes, but maybe only lose two places. If it's a point system, you only lose 2 points on someone. But 2 minutes could be heaps.
Well, it depends on the point system, right? Because it's I know what you're saying. It's two places and 2 points. Yeah, if you skew it more to, if it's
easier to recover in a point system than it is to recover in a time system.
Yeah, and it also it rewards dominance in.
Yeah,
Paddle and Lure, I think, will surprise a few people because there's quite a. It's not a flat water pump in, but it's like a wind assisted or crosswind assisted pump in. And you could lose a lot of time like in that.
Yeah.
If you make a mistake in the wrong spot, you could lose minutes. And for a, 20 minute race, that's, 10Ks, 10, 12Ks. Yeah. So it's, you could lose a lot of time in a short race. And I guess I kind of like the time too, because it's scaling it, I guess, like the longer the race, the more important it is, because there's more time to gain or lose.
There's more incentive to race as well. Cause like say on a Mua or M2M, you're like, there's a guy in front of you and the gap's big. So you've got to take a risk to close it if it's on time.
Yes.
Which is a risk. But if it's on points, you just go, it's 1 point or a couple points.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you can play more tactics and it's like, I'm going to save my energy. But if it's purely on time, you're incentivized to push yourself.
For sure.
Especially if you want to win. Mm. And you have to push. And that makes it interesting as well, I think. I'm all for time, personally. I think the only way that points works is if you run pretty much the same course many times or similar distance many times. you give people the option for throwaways, but even then that's difficult because that's how it works in sailing, right? But they run regattas with multiple races. So if you've got two races or three races and you want to run the points in a throwaway, it kind of doesn't work, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I'm not a sailor, so I don't really know the details of it, but from a green perspective, I'm like, that makes no sense. If we run six races and you can throw away your worst one, yeah, fine. But if we run two races, why would you do it?
And what do you think of multi-day events versus single races? Like, I guess to me, because M2O has changed, like it's not the traditional M2O course. Like, I think to me the Triple Crown is like almost got more prestige than Molokai Tuahu now, in like some, you know, not weird way, but it's more important to win the whole thing than it is just to win the one race.
I think I'm a big fan of multi-day. I like the idea. You know, it also, if you have one-off races, it's also like, it's just a snapshot.
Yeah.
But in terms of like, if you want to really, let's not lie, like racing is partly about ego, right? It's partly about demonstrating you are, because you're
the alpha, right?
Yeah. I want to win. I want to be the best.
Yeah.
So if you really want to emphasize that statement, you just like multi-day, whoever is the best, different runs, different conditions, combine it all. That is really
shows the overall. What do you think of M2O and M2M being 2 days apart?
I think it will separate the athletes from. Yeah, I'm a fan.
Yeah,
I mean, I've come from my competitive backgrounds in athletics, right? So you just run 3 days in a row. Sometimes twice in a day, depending on how the competition's structured.
Yeah.
I think it's good. I think it's quite cool as well because everyone's together on Molokai and there's the run in the middle.
Yeah. Are you planning on doing that?
Depends on how tired I am after M2M.
Yeah.
Part of me wants to because I'm there, right? How often are you on Molokai?
I'm kind of the same as you. Like, how much is a 10K downwind actually going to fatigue me? You know, is it? And if it depends how you look at it. If you look at it as another race, it probably will. But if you look at it as like a bit of a fun run, kind of warm down, warm up, you're pretty fun. You're cool.
Keep the legs moving. Yeah, I think. Yeah, I don't. I think it's quite cool that they're close together. I think those that are prepared well, it won't really impact them at all.
Yeah. I'm not gonna lie. I think I like it. Like you said, it makes it more of an endurance event. It's less of a like sprint. And as I'm older, I guess it suits me. You know, and I can train for that. Whereas if I was younger, I'd be like, man, you're doing. Look, I put it this way: if I was doing it on a stand up, when like M2M on a stand up is like 3.5 or 3 hours, I think it's about 3 hours. No, 2.5 hours, and then M2O is like 3 hours. So it's like that's a different proposition. But M2M's like on a foil is, what is it like? Guys will probably do it under 2 hours, and M2O is probably going to be, you know, closer to two and a half. The winning time will be under 2.5, I would have thought. 60K.
I think so.
Yeah. So it's.
I'm all for it. I think anything to make it more challenging adds to the prestige of the event.
Mm.
If you make it easy and everyone can do it, I think it devalues or detracts from.
Well, what do you think of the change in course then to M2O? What's your thoughts on that? And did you sign up knowing it was going to be changed?
No, I didn't. I was open to doing the old course. I'm quite, having never done it before, I don't know. I'm sure there will be some purists who comment on the fact that it's different. I think then having the the M2M 2 days before will still make it hard. I think it's cool because it'll be pure downwind foiling. And I think that's been probably the biggest criticism of the old course.
Oh, for sure.
People, right? They're like, oh, but it's not a pure downwind race. So it's just whoever can float water paddle up at the start and who can pump them up the best at the end.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of in the middle and it doesn't allow for the best foil choice to go fast. So
yeah.
From a downwind foil race perspective, I think the new course change is really good. Because mm-hmm. we'll see, hopefully, blistering speeds.
Yeah.
You know, there'll be guys that really go for it for 60Ks, which is cool. And then, yeah, what the purists want or think, that's just, I think that's more tradition.
Yeah.
Based on it, having done other disciplines, right? As someone who's never done the other disciplines, it doesn't really play into me, my thoughts.
Yeah, yeah, Saki. Yeah, yeah.
Both sides of the argument.
Yeah. No, it is what it is, you know, and what's that?
You'll have done both. You'll have done both, so you'll be the best to comment after, especially if you win both.
Yeah, that'd be nice. But the it's almost like I don't even want to comment until the course is done because there's every chance on the day that, like, on paper it looks a lot easier, you know. But yeah, you know,
who knows?
Extra 10Ks could be going at that sort of race pace, could be hard, and you know, there's also every chance that we don't get wind. You know, it's windy most days over there in that time of year, but you can get, like, the first year I did Molokai to Awa on a SUP, there was no wind and there was a big south swell. And that was like, if we were doing the new course, it'd be harder than the old course because it's longer and you could catch waves from China Wall all the way to the finish on the old course. So it's, I think last year we got a bit skunked on wind, which it made the start a lot harder than what it had been. And it actually, funnily enough, it made the finish a bit easier because of less wind, but there was no swell. There wasn't much swell either. So it made it hard. The finish is never, it's not a good spectacle for the finish, I guess is the best way to say it. You're almost better off watching the finish from China Wall than you are the actual finish line because you can.
Some of the messages I got this year from people. They were like, oh, but the most exciting part was the finish. And now that the course has changed, it won't be. But I was like, but it was only exciting because that was the only exciting bit. For the rest, it was just like people were just foiling across. Whereas now you've got like a full downwind race. So the whole thing should be exciting because everyone, in theory, if we have good conditions, should get up. And then it's pure downwind foil racing.
Yeah.
It's not about who got the best flat start or who got
for sure. It's less tactics now, you know. It's more who can piece together the best run, you know, rather than flat water start, middle, finish upwind. Whereas now it's a full down run. And some people said to me, does it mean that the first person that's winning in the first 10Ks is going to be winning for the entire race? There's that risk and it makes it less exciting. But the channel's not going to be the same all the way across. And, you know, if you have one fall, then, you know, that could make, it should be really tight racing. You know, it should be closer. And
there will 100% be people that cramp up and, you know, I don't think we're at the stage yet where we've got the super freaks that can just pump nonstop for three races in a week.
Yeah, like, I don't think so. I'm not that.
Gage did that thing in the surf, right? But there's no one in downwind foiling right now who is a full-time athlete who solely trains only for this. So we don't have those specialists who are just pump kings. And until that happens, there will be people that cramp or whatever. So it's not whoever goes fastest in the first 10K. If someone could pump their legs out after 10K and just be, dead.
Well, the beauty of, to me, the beauty of the longer races and the back-to-back races is it's going to reward efficiency because you can't pump the whole way across the channel because it's just, it's too physically taxing, like for a level that I guess we're at.
No.
Like you mentioned. Yeah.
Unless someone like takes a cyclist or a rower and converts them to a Darwin foiler, which I don't think would work anyway, because they're just
the skill factor. And like, this is the thing. So my dad used to do Ironmans, and like he sort of helped me when I first started doing Molokai, and he sort of explained, okay, this is what you want to do. You want to try this pace and this pace. I'm like, but dad, if the conditions change, like the pace is irrelevant. I need to be sprinting and then surfing and then sprinting and then surfing. And he's like, harder to train for. You got to learn to sprint and surf and sprint and surf. And that's like, you got
facets. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a different.
I think the new course will be good for downwind foiling.
Yes, agreed. I think it's going to be better for this sport as a whole. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the whole argument, old course versus new course, is more tradition versus
for sure.
The sport of downwind foiling.
I'll just throw this out here. So the foils are doing the course, the race from Molokai to Oahu in last year. I think it was like around, it was like it was 2:15 or something like that. The winner for stand up was over 3 hours. The winner for like the women's prone is like 6 or 7 hours.
Yeah.
So I guess my argument is, if a foil can do it in like the slowest foiler, say he's doing it in 4 or 5 hours, the slowest prone paddler is doing it in like 8, 9, 10 hours. Yep. So if they can paddle upwind at the finish, then why can't we paddle upwind at the finish for the tradition of the course? That's the only questions I had. It's like, well, I've always seen Molokai to Oahu not as a downwind race, but as an ocean race.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah. You know, that's, and like M2M is your downwind race.
Yeah.
But like I said, like I'm open to it. And I'm as you said, it's going to make it more competitive. It's going to make it more, it's going to grow the sport better. And maybe they'll change it back whenever, like, I think when everyone's skills are a bit better, the flat start and the flat finish isn't going to be as big an issue. But it's early days. It's early days. It's not even 10 years into the discipline as a whole, and the racing side of thing kind of is only really just starting to take off.
Yeah.
That's cool. I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be cool. Just another.
I think it's be a good time with a lot of really like, cool people.
Like-minded, foil-brained people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything you want to leave us with, John? You want to, like, any parting words?
Oh, I don't know if I have any parting words of wisdom. Don't go too small just because you get sucked into the hype. It's funny because we ride smaller foils in similar conditions when it's for fun, right?
But yeah,
racing is just different. But I think it's all about the people and the community at the end of the day, and even the races. The best thing about them is all the people that you get to catch up with.
Yeah.
So I think people shouldn't lose too much sight of that at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's about the community, not the racing. Yeah.
No.
Where do you, I got one last question. Where do you think foiling will be, like downwind foiling will be in another, let's say 10 years? What do you think it's going to be? Where do you foresee it going, I guess?
As a whole, so like wing, sup, foil drive.
Yeah, I think everything, but I think, you know, mainly downwind foil, I think, because so this podcast.
Yeah, but isn't like foiling as a discipline with the use of a wing or foil drive or a paddle, I think that's going to become like a significant part of the sport.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who was it? I think we're talking to Dan about it. Like foiling is going to turn into like cycling. So you've got cycling and then you've got mountain biking, you've got road biking, you've got cyclocross, whatever. And it's going to become like one giant sport.
Mm-hmm.
With sub-disciplines. And I think downwinding is going to be a really big sub-discipline because like here, like we don't get waves. Like let's not kid ourselves. Most of the stuff that what we do is effectively downwinding. For a lot of places, downwinding is the best discipline. The hardest thing is shuttles. And I think once people either start offering shuttle services, there's a business model to be had there, I think.
Yeah.
If do it, and more people get into it, I think a lot of people will be downwinding. So I think that's the direction that we're going. I think downwinding is going to grow a lot. Maybe not paddle. That might have a slower growth rate, but I think wake and downwinding and foil drive downwinding is relevant. And for the sub guys who are purists, you need more shuttles anyway. So embrace the wingers, embrace the foil drivers. And if you don't want to wait, make sure your car's at the finish. I think that's what the way we're going. I think more and more people are going to get into it.
Yeah.
Get away from the surf spots, get away from the crowded places and just go enjoy the freedom that the foils enable us to have that a lot of other sports don't have.
Yeah. I think that's good. I like that. I think that's be interesting to see how it pans out. 10 years is it's a decent amount of time, but it's something that we can, I guess, check back on in. We'll maybe in 10 years' time, I'll set a reminder now, see if you're right.
Maybe we'll all be foil driving by then.
I think, look, winging and foil driving to me are both have their pros and cons. And the obvious pro is you get up easier. The obvious con is you're then dealing with some form of having to manage the wing or having to manage your height with the prop.
Yeah.
So there's like that's where the paddle is less of a hindrance than a wing or a prop in my opinion, coming from a paddling background. But the fact that people use selfie sticks to show they're not using a paddle is strange to me because the paddle you can hold in one hand as well.
Yeah.
But you can use your paddle as a selfie stick. But I get it. I know why they, I get the no paddle thing. But
I inherently like the reason I haven't tried a foil drive to downwind is because I'm lazy, right? And I like to cut out far to sea, but I also like the confidence that I can paddle up. And I have this like nightmare scenario in my head that someone goes 3Ks out to sea and I don't know, they run out of battery because they haven't been paying attention. 3K paddle back on a prone board is not fun. And that's, 3K paddle back on a downwind board is all right. So
that's sort of my same issue with the wing too. Like sometimes you go out to sea and the wind drops. I can get up easier with a paddle than I can with a wing.
Exactly, yeah.
Like zero knots with a wing is not possible, whereas zero knots with a paddle is possible.
I've done that as well. Yeah, so I mean, paddle, who knows, maybe we'll all be paddling in 10 years then. But it's really cool. Like there's such a range of people getting into it now. It's hard to say.
Yes, no, it'd be exciting. Well, thanks so much for your time, John. We've gone a little bit out of time. But I appreciate it. And I look forward to catching up with you in Maui.